Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Adam Short, host of Grit in the Wild podcast. Adam, it's good to be back and to talk all things. Today we're talking about Bethel. And interestingly, just this week, I have pushed out a 30-minute documentary clip on Branham to Bethel, trying to summarize all of my thoughts of all of the research that I've done for, it's probably been 5 years now, about from Branham to the shepherding, to the charismatic, to the NAR, how all that ties together. Just published that, and apparently it's making waves throughout all of the communities. And yeah. So today, focusing on Bethel, I think we'll ride those waves.
Let's do it. Yeah, I watched that last night, and incredible. I think it is the best rendition that I've seen that really takes the thread all the way back from William Branham, and even prior to William Branham, you know, all the way to Bethel, and really connects the dots for many of us like myself who this is very new to still. And it's only been really in the past, year and a half or so, year-ish, that I came across your research and didn't realize that all of these these historical movements are all connected. It's not an accident. It's quite intentional and by design. And so I found that documentary to be extremely, extremely helpful, you know, highlighting the key figures going back to the 40s and then all the way to now with Bethel. So, and it's kind of cool too. You had the alliteration going, you had the Branham to Bethel is kind of a nice, ring to it. So,
yeah. And there's so much more that I could say, but I thought, you know, if I get down in the weeds, nobody's going to really follow it. And it solved a couple of problems for me, right? So I've had a few charismatic people who are, I gave their story on the podcast, and had some Pentecostals. I actually have another Pentecostal guy that I'm working on trying to get him on here. Okay. But I've got friends in all of these movements that I'm exploring their histories and their very critical information that has been hidden.
Yeah.
And interestingly, most of them are curious to find out, you know, what has been hidden for me. But then you find these groups that if I mention one name that's in one of these connections, that as I'm connecting Branham all the way to Bethel, I can mention a name and you can watch all of their cult of personality just go berserk. Oh no, wow. He's connecting this figure. And it's not necessarily that I'm saying anything bad about the figure. It's just that it is a node in my big schema of connections. So this was a way that I could publish that and kind of show how all of this came to be. And I think it's eye-opening for a lot of people.
Oh man, it's so eye-opening because many of us, including myself, were not taught that there was that direct connection there. We were taught in fragments. And what I mean by that is, for example, I'll tell you a couple examples here. So, and I've mentioned this before, but God's Generals, right, being one of the big sort of anchors to the BSSM education curriculum there. And I think they still read that book in BSSM, I believe, last I heard. And of course, you get the gamut with the God's Generals of all of these quote unquote heroes of the movements that went before us and then led us to where we are now. So you had that as the anchor, and then you also had the William Branham Blue Books, and we had to read the first six of those in the BSSM. And I actually heard from a more recent BSSM alumni graduate recently that they no longer, according to him, they no longer include those books in the curriculum, which actually surprised me. I don't know what the reason or decision was there. If they're trying to sort of put William Branham in more of the back seat, I'm not sure, because even recently you can pull up clips of people like Chris Ballatin and others talking about going after or receiving the mantle of William Branham. And so it's still there. I just think that they maybe have sort of couched it or put it sort of in the back seat a little more. So we had those books, and then we also had John G. Lake's book, I can't remember. Did he write that book? You know what I'm talking about, the real thick book, John G. Lake, his whole story of healings and, you know, really all of his biography. So those were the three anchors that directly tied BSSM curriculum back to those movements. So in my mind, it was a fragmented thing. I had no idea, though, that those predecessors, as it were, were the people that sort of architected these movements that we now live in. So back to your, you know, documentary, I just found it to be super, super helpful. It definitely helped connect more dots for me that I wasn't unaware of, like that kid you mentioned in there. I forgot the kid's name now, but there was a kid that you highlighted in the video that was sort of elevated at a young age.
David Walker.
That was elevated.
Is the key word, man. He was using levitation as part of his ploy to attract the Christians.
I was going to ask you about that. So, you know, and if you've, and I've mentioned this before, I kind of am interested in, I've always been interested in magic. Like, and what I mean by magic is magic that's not like supernatural magic, like more of the David Blaine or Chris Angel or David Copperfield kind of people. So, and there are street magicians who do that kind of stuff. Like they actually can, and I saw one on Twitter the other day, this dude was literally like, he was able to remove his legs from his body and it looked so real. But then they had a camera angle from the back and they showed the whole like get up he had to put on. It's like he's strapped into this, there's like a frame, but you can't see it from the front. So is that what this guy did, or is there any evidence about how he was able to sort of lift up off the stage like that?
You know, I get asked that question so many times. I wasn't there, so I didn't get to see it. But like you, I love magic. I love being tricked, as long as I'm not being manipulated while I'm
correct.
Tricked. That's the
correct.
Difference, right?
Total difference. This
was totally manipulation of crowds. But
yeah.
So Chris Angel, you mentioned.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. I used to love that. What was it called? Mind Freak, that show that he had.
Yes. Yeah. I saw him in Vegas live, by the way.
Oh, wow. I would love to. I've never seen him live. I would love it. But
it's intense.
I love this kind of thing. And I love trying to figure it out, because mm-hmm. I know when I'm watching a magician, I know I'm being tricked. I want to figure out, how did they do it?
Yes.
And one of the tricks that Chris Angel has, and he's pretty good at it, is levitation. And he'll walk down the stairs to a crowd and then just suddenly float up into the sky. People are wondering, what in the world is he doing? Now, there's different ways in which they do this.
Okay.
But he, one time in one of his episodes, he was showing exactly how he did it at ground level. And he did it in just the same exact setting that little David Walker was at. He's standing in front of a crowd, and there was a chair behind him, just like little David. There was a chair behind little David. And what they do is they have a special shoe that's made that is attached to the leg of the pants.
Okay.
And you can slide your shoe out and bend your knee and put it up onto the chair and then lift up, and the shoe is still hanging. So it looks like you're levitating, but you're actually just using the muscles of your leg. Now, again, I wasn't there. I didn't see it. But this is an actual trick that Chris Angel explained how he did it.
So as you explain that, it is what I saw on Twitter. This dude was all dressed up. It was like the Tin Man from Wizard of Oz. It was like all silver. And if you've ever been to San Francisco, unfortunately the dude that used to do this, I understand, passed away, but there's the Bush Man in San Francisco right there on the Embarcadero at the Fisherman's Wharf. Walked by him so many times I can't even count when I lived in California. Well, the Bush Man would jump he would jump out from the bush. He was dressed up like a bush, okay? And here he is on the sidewalk. You know, all these hundreds of people just walking down the sidewalk. They're just looking at the Fisherman's Wharf and wanting to get their San Francisco sourdough bread and this, that, and the other. And here comes the Bush Man. He jumps out, and you don't see that the bush is the man. He jumps out, and it's so funny. You watch people jump literally into the Embarcadero street with this oncoming traffic. So that you got the Bush Man, and then next to him, it's just so funny just thinking back. You got the Tin Man. And so when I saw this video, it reminded me of the Tin Man that used to hang out in San Francisco. And he's dressed up like this silver suit. And they had the two camera angles, just like you're talking about. And behind him, I don't think they had a chair in his specific like suit, but it was what you described. There's like a pole and then attached to his pants. But anyway, they explained, they showed all that. So it checks out kind of like what you're describing here. I think they probably evolved in their technology since the 1940s, John. So now they've got a better suit that you can put on or something.
Yeah, I've seen that same trick. And there's like, I think he's holding a cane. And then what happens is up his sleeve, he's got a pole that's attached to the cane. So
that's it.
It's crazy funny. But if you think about how all of this evolved, so Branham is attracting the crowds during an era in which the spiritualist movement had swept through the United States. Everybody is fascinated with mediums and spirits and wizards and all of these different things that aren't Christian, right? They're actually anti-Christian. So Branham comes along, and he does this by learning from his predecessor, Roy E. Davis. Davis came in, same kind of thing. He had some gimmicks that was based off of spiritualism. Well, this attracted the crowds, and they attracted all of these people into a version of Christianity that mixed and blended the spiritualist aspects of talking, communication with the dead, and you know, all divination, all of this stuff, all of the things that are abominations in the Old Testament. You know, you're reading through the Old Testament, it's condemning everything they're doing,
right?
But they've bundled it up and branded it with you know, pseudo Christianity. But little David represents the worst extreme of this, because they've actually taken magician stage acts and that they're calling Christianity. And he's levitating with the power of God. When you think about Bethel and the, you know, they call it Hogwarts, which is kind of funny, but if you think about what's happening there and then think about this history, all of it suddenly makes sense.
And just to go back for a second to the point you made when you were talking about how you love magicians, and I do too. I've always been fascinated with magicians. Even as a kid, I had a magic trick, whatever you call it, kit, try to impress people. But see, that's the thing. That's the difference, is when you pay for a ticket to go see a magician, whether it's Vegas or whatever, David Blaine, I got to see him live in Charlotte. And you pay money knowing that you're going to be entertained, right? That this is a professional that specializes in illusions, or in David Blaine's case, it's not just illusions, it's also stunts of endurance, that he actually trains for this stuff, and he's actually doing this stuff. Like, he'll get in, like, he did a record amount of time in a container of ice water. I think he still has the world record for holding his breath the longest underwater for 17 minutes. That's not actual magic. That's not an illusion. That is really something that's being done by a human. So one category over here, we got magicians and entertainers that you know you're going in and you're paying money to be entertained, right? And you're suspending your belief when you go in there because, hey, I'm getting entertained. That's one thing, right? But then you put that same type of illusion in the context of a Christian church or Christian worship service or a tent meeting like they used to do back in the day, that's a whole different can of worms. And people are not going in expecting to be deceived or manipulated. And that is the crux of why this is so evil. One of the reasons, one of the many reasons. So going, like, bringing this forward to Bethel, you know, one of the things I thought that we could talk about was, it's not really along the lines of magicians or magic tricks, but it does touch on that because of the way they recently did this Bethel Communion Revival on April the 5th at Bethel, at the baseball field. And I'll give a shout out to Richard Moore, who has been covering this at length, in depth. He actually did three different 2 or 3 hour videos on this, where he actually critique the entire video feed of this event that happened at Bethel. And it was led by Lou Engel, who, if you're familiar with Lou Engel, he was sort of the architect behind the Justice House of Prayer, very connected to IHOP over the years. And he also did The Call, which was a series of events where thousands and thousands of people would pray and fast in stadiums. And so he's done that over the years. He's known for pushing 40-day fasting. He's also very connected to Bethel, very connected to Morningstar. So he and Dean Briggs, and Dean Briggs is a former leader of IHOP KC, who actually spoke out about the abuse that Mike Bickle perpetrated. He spoke out publicly in a church service at Forerunner Christian Fellowship in Kansas City. So to his credit, Dean Briggs did speak out publicly about Mike Bickle, but he's still very much involved in pushing the NAR teachings and leading these events. So Dean Briggs, Lou Engel, Bill Johnson, and Chris Fallotson all came together, and they had this Bethel Communion Revival event on April the 5th. And it was at the Bethel baseball field, and it was actually a six-hour event. And the whole premise was based on this series of prophecies and dreams that Lou Engel and Benny Johnson received. And it had to do with the Sacramento River. And I don't have all of these specifics of the prophecy in front of me, but the essence of it was this, that the Sacramento River would turn red, which would represent the blood of Jesus, and it would flow all the way down California. And this would initiate a revival. And the way that they were going to release this revival is they get everybody together and they have a communion service. And by doing this communion service, we're going to release the healing, we're going to release revival, we're going to release salvation, and all of the supernatural manifestations of the kingdom of God. And so they did that. They actually had a six-hour event, and it was a lot of worship. There was a lot of declarations. You can go on Bethel's YouTube channel and watch it. It's 6 hours. I've seen most of it. I've seen about five out of it so far from Richard Moore. And there's a lot in there. There's a ton of stuff in there that needs to be talked about. And I've got a few things I'd like to highlight, but that's kind of the big picture of what happened. And you know, they believe that through this ritual, through this practice of communion, that they are going to be the brokers of power and release this revival throughout California and then the rest of the nation.
So I had never heard of this until you actually brought it up this morning, first time I had heard. And I did some brief, you know, Google searches to see what this was. And as I was hoping it would be so that we could talk through it, this was more of a spiritual activation than it was a communion. This was more about a kind of like a new age thing where they're bringing down the power through communion. Yeah. And what's interesting historically about that, I grew up in Branham's church. My grandfather had taken it over. And if you have ever been to, it's not even open anymore. They've moved to another building. But if you were ever here whenever my grandfather led it, it was like a wax museum, man. Every single thing that Branham did to the letter, my grandfather did to the letter. Every ceremony, they had communion. It was much like Bethel, I would describe it. It was a spiritual activation. It wasn't what communion is intended to be.
Right.
And I never knew this. After I left the cult and I went to other churches, they had communion, and they call it different things. Some call it just simply the Lord's Supper. But what they have in the normal churches represented more of what the biblical practice was. This was all about remembering what Christ had done, and it was all about coming together in fellowship. And when you come together in fellowship, come in remembrance of me, Jesus Christ.
Right.
So the first time I experienced that, I was like, well, this is dry. What is this that we're doing? There is no power. There is no mystical glory coming down from the heavens. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather would give this little speech that I'm pretty sure he said that it came exactly from what Branham said. But it was basically that the communion was a showdown. It was a battle of the forces of good and evil right here in the building.
Interesting.
And if you, he focused heavily on the passage that said, whosoever eats unworthily, he focused on that in such a way that if you were to eat it with any little thought of sin in your life, you were doomed to hell from that moment forward. He scared the bejesus out of you, especially as a kid.
Yeah.
And so you're, and it gets real quiet when he's doing it, and he's talking real slow to manipulate your head, and right. you're going to die forever if you do this unworthily, my friend. And so the fear of a false god was in your head. Well, then everybody would go through, they'd line up. We interestingly drank out of these little, I think they do this in some of the other churches, but little vials of little tiny glasses mm-hmm. filled with wine.
Yeah.
In a cult that teaches you that to drink wine is sin. So he's first telling
oh,
you,
yeah. so
don't eat the wafers and if you're sin, but oh, by the way, we're going to take this little sin and we're going to ignore it while we do yeah. this, right?
It's okay to do it while you're doing communion.
it's crazy, man. And then, so after all this is said and done, everybody's gone through their fear for the night. My grandfather would stand... The communion wafers and drinks were on this weird shelf-like platform that had these poles that he could stand and hold like this, and he would lean forward and he'd say, "Now this that remains shall be burned before the dawn of another day."
Oh my gosh.
And just scare the crap out of you, man. Like the wafers themselves have some kind of spiritual power.
Right.
So this was... apparently, this was exactly like Branham did it. Uh-huh. So all okay. throughout Latter Rain, anybody who visited his church, they're seeing this, and they're seeing that communion is more than just fellowship like the yeah. other churches have. The other churches have gotten cold and formal. We need yeah. to bring down the power. This is a spiritual battle when we take communion.
So to hear you describe that, John, it's like I'm going back to my days in Bethel, right? And it wasn't like Bethel had communion a lot, but it was very much similar to what you described, although I don't remember anybody standing up and doing that at the end. Like, what, how did you put it? Like, it's going to be burned. I don't remember that part. That's probably a little extra that y'all had that we didn't have. But it just goes to show, like, very, very similar repackaging, rinse and repeat, you know, now in Bethel. And I just want to talk about some of the loadedness, the loaded language. It's not just loaded language, but it is literally a psychological framework and a psychological frame of mind that is a follower of these movements that you get into. And I remember I was watching this stuff, these videos that Richard Moore did, where he had the video feed on one side and Richard's commentating on the other side. And I'm just like, I feel like I'm getting triggered just by watching this, because it just brings back all of the the hype, that sort of the psyching up, like you got to get yourself psyched up to make these declarations, to bring heaven to earth. And there's just so much loaded spiritual, like you said, activation, but spiritual, it's like spiritual activity or spiritual, I've got to like pull down and make this happen. And I want to talk about that for a minute. I think that this is a specific example of the upside down false teaching that we're seeing here. It is actually false. It's not what the Bible teaches when it comes to the gospel. And I think that you've helped me understand that this actually traces its way back to the manifest sons of God doctrine, because deep down embedded in this belief system is the belief that we are, if not little gods walking around, we're pretty close. And by extension, if you are little gods, little deities walking around, then it stands to reason that you have the ability to unlock heaven and bring that stuff down here on earth. And really, if I could distill that, I think what this is it's teaching people that they are brokers. They're like brokers of heaven. But the fact of the matter is this is all about what Jesus did. The true gospel is all about what Jesus did when he gave his life as a ransom for many. It's not about we go in, we get together, and we're somehow going to pull this stuff down and release it to the earth. That's not the gospel. That is a performance hamster wheel religion. It is not being saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. And whether you believe in God or you don't, for those that do, like what we're taught in the Bible is the antithesis of this, this practice of I've got to, this, it's like the sun, the moon, stars have to align. We all have to get together and we literally have to yell and scream so loud and make these decrees and declarations. And at what point is it enough? At what point have you finally decreed enough and you've taken communion enough to where enough power has been released to affect a change in the world? And so, and it goes a step further, right? It's not just we're going to have this communion revival event. We're now going to go out into Reading. We're going to go out into California. We're going to go out into wherever you are in the world, and we're literally going to take over the seven mountains. And you see how one simple belief from the Manifest Sons of God doctrine extends and then becomes like an actual practical outworking of how people live their lives in their careers, in entertainment, in their businesses, and just, and even like city council in Reading, where I think they have two or three members of city council are Bethel members now, or they go to Bethel. So that's a whole nother sort of rabbit trail, but that's kind of like the practical outworkings of how this stuff happens.
One of the really interesting things that they have copied from Branham is very powerful, and I don't think people have fully grasped what this is and why and how. Whenever I talk about the spiritual warfare and how much of it is coming from Branham and how much of it is really wrong, you watch the comment feeds kind of explode, because in the Bible, it does talk about spiritual warfare. But what they have developed, we go back to the Chris Angel type of spiritual warfare, what they've developed is not the same as what is being described in the Bible. And this has a strategic purpose. So Branham invented the idea, or copied others, I should say. I don't think he invented this, but he helped support the idea that we were always engaged in spiritual warfare, no matter what we do. If you go to the post office and somebody takes your parking space as you're trying to pull in, well, that's the devil. He's gotten your mm-hmm. way. I mean, that's a hyper extreme example, mm-hmm. but you're really thinking in this way. You're thinking angels and demons everywhere you go.
Right.
And the reason why that is strategic is because along with that doctrine comes this notion, this false notion, that if you study the other side and learn what is a demon, learn what is New Age, what is spiritualism, what are all these things that are evil, if you study it, you might accidentally catch the demon because, oh, by the way, in this latter rain / beyond movement, Jesus mm-hmm. is not powerful enough to protect you. That's one of the false yeah. notions that got planted in your head.
Yep.
So people are afraid to study the other side. I, after I left, I became no longer afraid. I've studied things that it's a little shocking to me exist, but mm-hmm. one of the things, it's not shocking this part, but I studied the New Age religion some, and it's really funny if you look at it, because if you talk to a person who is really in this New Age movement, they say it's not a religion. This is just a philosophy and a way of life. We're one with the earth, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah.
But what they're doing isn't Christian. It is, in essence, yeah. it is a religion in its essence.
Yeah.
But what has happened is, because of the structure that Branham created, this fictional fantasy magic show structure, they've created this idea that we can take New Age ideas like activation.
Yeah.
And when we do this communion ceremony, we're activating. We're bringing down the glory of the Spirit, etc. Yeah. We're doing it. It's not mm-hmm. that the Holy Spirit has moved and he's come. We're initiating it. That's New Age activation. And you can if somebody were to just open up New Age, I think you can even go to the Wikipedia article and just yeah. pull up and read through some of the comments, you'll be shocked at how much of it is like Bethel Similar. 101.
This is part of my personal deconstruction journey. And you forget about a lot of the stuff that you were exposed to until somebody starts talking about it. And you're like, oh my gosh, yeah, that too, just add it to the list. So I'll give you another example. But first, to your point, absolutely. Like, I have been listening a lot lately to some of the more of the cessationist podcasters, like Justin Peters, Steve Kozar. I believe they all would identify as cessationists, meaning they don't believe that the gifts of the Spirit are for today. And other people like Richard Moore. I don't know if Richard Moore would say he's a cessationist. He seems to me that he does lean that direction. So I've been learning a lot. I've been getting a lot out of their takes on just looking at the Bible and like comparing the stuff that we were indoctrinated in, you know, in Bethel years ago. And it's just starkly different. So here's an example of something I've identified in my own life that I was exposed to that I like categorically, I know it's New Age. And it was talked about in the Physics of Heaven book. It was written by Judy Franklin. Judy Franklin was one of the authors, and then I forgot the other author, but I think Bill Johnson wrote the foreword, if I'm remembering correctly. Check me out on that. But that book came under fire and has been criticized quite a bit because it's very similar to a lot of the New Age practices, one of which is trips to heaven. So this is something that when I was at BSSM, this was a type of practice or an event you could go to. It was like after hours. And I think she even did it, Judy Franklin did it during some of the sessions at BSSM. So what they do is they clear out all the chairs out of the sanctuary. I don't know if they still do it in the sanctuary, but back then it was in the sanctuary. All the chairs get cleared out and you go in and everybody lays down on the floor. Okay. You got 500 people, 800 people laying on the floor. Judy's up in the front. And she leads people into a trip to heaven. And it's almost like a visualization of going to heaven and visualizing Papa God. And like, you're going in, you're going to see the throne of God and all this stuff. And, you know, I don't know that I experienced that like legitimately when I was laying down on the floor. I don't recall seeing, you know, like the throne of God or having some kind of encounter at that time. But now looking back, and I remember just hanging out with friends, like we would try to do this stuff too. We'd be like, oh, let's take a trip to heaven. That was just kind of like common, like just what you do in your free time at Bethel is like, we're going to hang out as friends and go take trips to heaven. Now I look back on that and having been more informed about where that stuff came from, I actually am convinced now it is astral projection. It's astral projection, which is, I think, a New Age practice, but probably even worse. I think there might be even some more dark connotations there associated with it. So I don't want to have anything to do with that anymore. Now, if you do astral projection, go for it. I'm just saying for me, like, I look back on that time and I'm like, okay, this is not the kind of stuff that the Bible teaches. Like, this is definitely not biblical. And if you're looking to refine your faith and sort of like chop off stuff that's not biblical, which I'm trying to do, and like reconstruct, which is sort of where I'm at in my journey, like those are the kind of things I want to sort of leave in the dust and not, I don't subscribe to that anymore.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. What you're describing goes a little bit beyond New Age, and then you start to feeling really uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And this is the part in which, if you're a Christian who believes that there is a evil spirit that is swaying all of this away from Christianity, this is where it really gets problematic. Mm-hmm. Because what you're describing is basically the experience over the doctrine. I go and I have an experience, and because of this, I've opened a gateway to the supernatural. That's what happens in the occult, not in Christianity. You don't open gateways in Christianity. But they have so much focused on personal experience and how did John Wimber call it? The feels.
the feels, yeah.
You know, the way the way in which they have taken experience over doctrine to open up a channel to God, you have to wonder and question, well, which God is this? Because that's not how it's being described in the Bible. And then you look at the fruits of that. You've got all of the trances and people barking like dogs and things that you just can't really associate with Christianity. Interestingly, Wimber, towards the end of his life, I'm told he wiped his hands of this because of those things. So he saw that he had opened this gateway, and he saw that whatever happened, happened. And my opinion is he opened the floodgates, because now people were copying this and it turned into this big mess that exists today.
Right.
But this is very similar. If you study the occult, this is very similar to the way in which they bring on a trance in the occult. Mm. And people get so much focused on the experience that they have this almost out of body, out of mind experience. They're entering into a trance. And if you compare what's happening in the occult with what's happening in these movements, and even though they're using the name Jesus, they're experiencing many of the same things.
Yeah.
It's a altered psychological state that they're entering. But again, if you're a Christian, you have to wonder, are they not summoning some sort of a demon?
That's the scary part too. And this is how Bethel would explain this, right? When people brought objections, not that I remember there being like big objections, like from individual people, but it was a part of the teaching that one of the, how do I say this? Like Bethel's approach was, so many of these things were hijacked by the dark side, and they were actually God-given types of manifestations of the supernatural. So the way they put it is the devil hijacked it, right? So for example, give you an example, divination, okay? Which divination is in the Bible, and it's practiced by people who were not using the Spirit of God. They were using another source. And it was a way to obtain knowledge that was largely unknown about events or people, and then given to people, kind of like fortune telling. So Bethel's teaching was, divination is an example of how the dark side or the enemy hijacked that. But you can't have a counterfeit if there's not a genuine, right? So that was the teaching. So now, many years removed from that, I look back and I say, okay, is that true? And this is something I'm literally working through right now in my journey. I'm trying to pick this stuff apart in my head. And I'm curious what people that are listening and watching think about this. But you take something like divination, and Bethel would say, the genuine manifestation of that is the prophetic gift, right? It's the gift of prophecy. It's the ability to prophesy from the Spirit of God, from the unction of the Holy Spirit. And I believe that prophecy is real. There is a real prophecy that exists. Now, the vast majority of what we see, I think, in the charismatic, hyper-charismatic movement is not biblical prophecy. It is something else, whether it's human contrived or from a dark source or a combination of the two, I don't know. But anyway, I'm trying to get through this in my head here. That was how Bethel explained it. So back to like taking trips to heaven, they would say, if you were to tell them these trips to heaven are astral projection, they'd say, nope, it's not. This is a genuine manifestation of something that was hijacked by the New Age and the occult. So I struggle with that, though, because I think that is based on a presupposition that just because something exists, that the alternative has to be genuine. But what do you think? I mean, is that a presupposition? Is that coming to the table with a bias? And so what I've kind of done is I've just taken a step back and I said, okay, is this in the Bible? Is it practiced in the Bible, specifically the New Testament? Are we taught to do this in the New Testament? And if not, I think it's pretty safe to go ahead and throw it out and like assume that it's probably not good to practice this stuff. You know what I mean? But I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Like, what do you think about that type of approach that Bethel does, where they say, because there's a counterfeit that has to be genuine of that same thing?
Well, what comes to mind for me is a trigger, because that was Branhamism 101. If there's a genuine, there must be a, if there's a counterfeit, there must be a genuine. He said this over and over and over again. So my thoughts are complex and still forming. I'm still working through my framework, but I think I can sum it up best like this. Along with that doctrine that Branham said this, he also would always go back to the passage in the Bible that said, greater works shall you do. And I'm certain you've heard Bethel use this, because this is copied throughout the NAR, right?
Yes.
After I left the Branham movement, I read the Bible over and over, kept trying to wash all of this out of my head. And there came a point in which I realized that, number one, the King James Version, the old Queen's English, isn't really explaining things that, in a way that I can understand it.
True.
It was written for the 1600s. Yep. There are words like kidney that's used to describe something that's not a kidney, but I think of a kidney today.
And that's funny.
You can go look that up. It's kind of a funny study. Another example is the rib. Eve was taken from Adam's rib. Well, the ancient word, ancient usage of the word rib, could also mean the rib of a hill, the side of a hill.
So it's
more like it came from the side of, you know, there's a lot of different examples like this that the language just isn't quite right. So I went beyond that and started studying some of the other versions, and I came to a point in which I realized, wait a minute, the way we're taught to read it is incorrect. We were taught with such literalism that to read a translation that doesn't have the same literal King James words is now offensive to me. So I went back to studying the interlinear version, where I could read and see what is the Greek word used and what does this mean. And I went through some of my trigger passages. One of these is greater works shall you do. Branham taught that his miracles were greater than Jesus. He said this outright, plainly, I'm bigger than Jesus. I did more miracles than Jesus did in his entire ministry. That's a phrase of Branham.
Okay.
And so he taught people that they could become miniature gods, and he went back to this verse. But if you study the Greek words of that verse, it's the meanings of the words are far more complex, but one of the words, and I can't remember which one it is, but it talks about greater in scope. And it's not necessarily talking about greater miracles shall you do, but you're going to do greater things because I've taught you a better way. In other words, I, Jesus, have came down and I've shown you a better way to live than you had lived in the past. And because you're going to set the example for future generations will become far better than we are today. If you read that passage in its essence. But Branhamism taught that this little God's notion, greater works shall you do, and taught that we could become little divine beings.
Yeah.
And that's why these schools like Bethel, that's why it exists. It's training you how to become this divine being. But what's interesting there is, while that structure was taught in Branhamism and in Bethel, what you find is it's flipped upside down from what Jesus had. Jesus said, greater shall you do. In other words, I'm teaching you a better way. You're going to go out and do them. And through the things that you do, the good deeds that you do, you are showing yourself to be more like me. But in these supernatural schools of ministry, and that was copied largely from Branham's deliverance seminars that he had with Lindsay, what they taught was a hierarchy. There's not a single rank and file member that can do what the elders can do, because the elders have more greater works than the rank and file members. So there's a hierarchy that they'll never achieve. And in doing so, you've created levels of miniature gods. So you've got the rank and file miniature gods, but at the top, you've got the central figure miniature god.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it was one of my points I wanted to hit. It's like we compared notes or something, but we didn't. So the whole concept of the hierarchy is very visible. If you go back and you look at the video on Bethel's YouTube channel, it's a 6-hour video. You don't have to watch the whole thing. Just, you know, flip forward and look at the camera view. And they've got a stage, right? You can't have an NAR event without a stage, of course, speakers, got a worship team. But in front of the stage, if you pay attention, there's a table. They look like a wood table, and it had, I don't know, 10 chairs around it, not commoner chairs, but the nicer chairs, I think. And I think the table's probably 12 or 15 feet long. It's a very nice table, but there are specific people who the seats are reserved for. And you'll notice, like, about 3 hours in, they finally get to taking communion, and they, you know, there's a whole bunch of lead up and build up to it. But Lou is there at the table, and next to him is Bill, and Chris is standing there, and, you know, several other people who we know and we're friends with and, you know, quite close with, right there at the, you know, they're at the table. But what's crazy is before that, Richard Moore highlights this in detail. They actually did, they called it a reenactment, John, of Revelation 5. So if you're not familiar with Revelation 5, that is the passage in the Bible where it describes the 24 elders that are gathered around the throne. Okay. So basically what they did is they conflated the 24 elders around the throne of God, worshiping him night and day, and they conflated that with this communion revival, communion thing that they're doing around the table. And the elders, the leaders at the event at Bethel, literally reenacted as if they're the elders gathered around the throne, okay? They called it a reenactment, and by doing that, they're releasing the spiritual, you know, the supernatural, whatever. But the point of this is there is a definite hierarchy that is visible all the way throughout this crowd. The common people are not allowed to approach the stage. The common people are not allowed to sit at the table. I would love to see what would happen if somebody tried to go sit down at the table. Like, that would be so funny. Like, if just somebody decided to run up. I mean, I'm sure the security, Bethel has a security team. I'm sure the security people would carry him away. But there is a definite hierarchy, and here's how it works. The higher up you are in the organization, the closer the proximity you have to the Lord's table. And so your proximity is a direct function of your position in that organization's hierarchy. So that's why the who's who is, you know, close to the table, whereas the people that are less important are further away. And, you know, what this reminds me of, John, and I'm not knocking the Catholic Church at all, because there's a lot of great people in the Catholic Church, but it is reminiscent of the structure of the cathedrals and these temple, not temples, what do they call Catholic? I guess they call cathedrals, where if you're a common person, if you're a lay person, there's a certain place that you go. You can't go past, what is that called? That gate back there where the pulpit is. It's kind of like a courtroom, right? Like, you can't go past that gate if you're not an attorney or a judge in the courtroom. You got to sit back here with the common people. So there's a separation between the laity, the stupid people, the peons, and the people that are smarter than you, the people that need to interpret the Bible for you, the people that are there as your intermediary between God and man.
We didn't compare notes, but we seem to be heading the same place, and we're coming full circle back to the beginning. So
yeah.
Picture the communion setting that I describe. Everybody's fear of their lives, man. If they eat that little thing, they may, it's really the showdown between life and death. If you eat that little wafer and you have some secret sin that you haven't confessed and got over, they taught perfectionism. You had to be perfect. If you weren't perfect and you took that wafer. And what happened was, I grew up with teenagers that, man, every teenager who's experience life has got some sort of thing that they can say, oh, I wish I didn't do that. That was wrong.
Right.
So entire groups of kids would never take communion because of this. It's really, really
awful.
Oh,
really? Oh, interesting. Yeah,
it's
because they
awful.
Were afraid that if they did, they'd be struck dead.
They'd be struck dead. Maybe not in this life, but, you know, you're taught that it's a doomsday cult. You're taught that any minute the world's going to end and
yeah.
you're not going to live on the other side if you eat this little wafer.
Oh, my gosh.
It was the showdown. Now, there were people who didn't catch that they were supposed to believe that, but I knew mm-hmm. people who struggled with this. But so you talked about the passage from Revelation, and so many triggers are going off because Branhamism, the theology, was the scroll that's mentioned in that passage.
They talked about this. Oh my gosh.
The scroll was the mystery of God, which was to be revealed in the last days. And Branham created this hierarchy in which the leadership would reveal what's in that scroll. So think about what you just said. You've got this hierarchy, right?
Yep.
So picture this communion room. We're sitting here thinking that we're so unworthy that we may even die if we eat that little wafer. Up on the platform, Branham is sitting in this cushy chair that looks like a king would sit in, mm-hmm. and you're sitting in, they didn't even have cushions in the pews. That's how bad this was. They added cushions later, but back when Branham was alive, this was the lowest form of servitude, mm-hmm. that you're sitting in the servants' quarters, basically.
Yeah.
And then what happened is, throughout the ministry, as Branham is revealing himself as the deity, he suddenly starts to mention that the mysteries on that scroll had been revealed to him. And so the passage where it says, who's worthy to open the scroll, he is now made worthy. Well, this disseminated through the movement, right? So Branham died, and the movement kept going. So now the leadership believes that they can bring on this end times revival, this end of days mm-hmm. revival. They're the ones who are worthy, and they're trying to keep the people in control so that their subjects can go into heaven under their authority. That was one of the doctrines that Branham taught.
Okay.
So everything that you've just described literally is a new take on Branhamism.
They spent a good chunk of time about the scroll. Okay. And I'm curious. There's a section in that video, if you care to go look. Lou is holding up the piece of bread. It's like he's holding it up to heaven. The camera angle shooting kind of up at him, and you see the sky. And, you know, all these decrees, declarations, I'm going to eat the body of Christ and take it in. I'm going to eat the scroll. He says, I'm going to eat the scroll. So there's like this direct comparison between I'm taking communion, the bread right here, the bread, he said, the bread of heaven, which to be fair is a quote from Jesus. He said he's the bread of heaven, but then mixing it with this, I'm going to eat the scroll. Like what you're talking about. That is crazy to me that like you just described where that originated. And I'm curious, did they talk about eating the scroll, or was that language used at all that you remember?
Well, there's a passage that comes straight out of the book of Revelation. There's a passage that talks about John being asked to eat the scroll. And I think, what is it, Ezekiel? There's another Old Testament book.
Ezekiel, yeah.
Yeah, that talks about the same kind of thing.
It's not us, the people, eating it. We're not the ones eating it, as I recall, right? Except John was in Revelation, but...
So in Branhamism, we didn't have symbolism of eating the scroll. But if you think in the grand scheme of things, what has happened, in Branhamism, if we were to have a ceremony like this, it's only the bride, the elect, the elite, that would be partaking of this. And then all other Christians would not. And so the symbolism matches what we had. The ceremony doesn't.
I find it fascinating that this is a theme and a direct teaching and practice that was in Branhamism that appears to now be practiced now at, you know, Bethel.
Yeah, I think you'd be surprised how much has actually developed and changed. I can see little hints and traces of it, but unless somebody understands the full scope of what it was in Branhamism, they don't make the connection. And mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend. I actually have a friend here who he has gotten a little bit involved with Bethel through watching them. And I was trying to explain some of the connections, and unless you really look at the theology behind it and understand, first off, you have to understand what the Bible says about what they're teaching. And then you have to understand exactly what they're teaching so that you can know the difference between the two. And in that difference, you usually find traces of Branhamism. So it's it's such a weird, complicated mess. But in the end, I'll go back with the question when I'm talking to either this friend or anybody else, why would you want something that you have to dissect and see what is the difference between what you're teaching in the Bible? Is not this a Christian church? Should not the Bible be your answer instead of Branhamism or wherever this came?
100%. And that's kind of where I've concluded is, you know, let's just put it all on a chopping block and let it all be examined. And, you know, I don't even have to parse every little thing in my head. I just want to go back to the one source of truth, which is the Bible, and throw everything else out. Because frankly, all of these ritualistic practices and these spiritual activations and this, that, and the other, let's be honest, it is exhausting. It's an exhausting hamster wheel to be in. And the great thing about the real gospel is it's a gospel of grace, and it's a gift. It's not something that I do, that we do as people to earn. We don't have to earn it. That's why it's good news. So that's been really refreshing for me to kind of, oh yeah, that's what this is actually about. It's not about, you know, coming up with some esoteric latest and greatest revelation to impress people and get people all riled up and like, oh my gosh, we're going to bring the kingdom. Like, that's not what Jesus taught us.
And you know, it's insidious the way in which they do it. They don't really come out and say things. So unless you're really listening with a critical ear, you miss it. I wish that Bill Johnson and some of the others would just come out and say, hey, today we're going to have a seance and we're going to summon Jesus. I think people might wake up and say, wait a minute, this is wrong, what you're doing. But he doesn't say it like this. But
nope.
If you look at the grave soaking and all of this weird stuff, he's literally doing that, but he's putting other terms. And he's not the only one is the scary part. So we could go down 1,000 rabbit holes. I think we'll save them for next time. But thank you for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and the Grit in the Wild podcast. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.